You are listening to One Nation Under Crime, a historical, chronological true crime podcast. Each week, we go through our nation's history and discuss cases from each year, starting in 1800. I'm Kayla.
And I'm Leah.
That's what I've just decided to go with.
I liked it.
Cases. However many we feel.
One, two, pick a few.
I mean, it's just four, ten. No, not ten. Well, I don't know. We get to the 70s.
I mean,
probably going to have a lot to choose from.
This is true. We could combine some.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I know. Some that are coming up are like some, I'll see some and I'm like, oh, that's going to.
We're going to have to do that one. We have to do that one.
Yeah. And I'm like, that's going to take a lot of research. Which, speaking of, we talked about this in way previous episode, but.
Way previous.
Everybody knows the case, and we discussed it, about Madame Lawlery.
I was just talking about her.
Really?
I got my hair did.
She's not a great topic of conversation sometimes, but.
No, well, I was talking about the podcast when I was getting my hair did,
mm-hmm.
and they were like, well, what are some cases? And I mean, you can't not bring her up.
Ugh, yeah. I mean, she's just one of those.
Well, I mean, I said she's a despicable person.
Oh, of course.
But that's one
mm-hmm.
case that you're like, oh, I mean, you can't not bring
yeah.
her up.
Well, and I liked that one too, because since we were in New Orleans and like our first episode was kind of, we did a few cases that were famous from there.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that. That was fun. But I did talk about in part two that it talked about the house and mm-hmm. the hauntings and whatnot going on. And I mentioned that they were going to allow a television crew to come in for the first time. I watched the episode the other day.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And?
Creepy. Creepy. Apparently, there's a lady that lives there that she's like the caretaker because the guy
that. She's got to live there?
Oh, yeah. She lives there. And they asked her, like, what happened? Like, you know, what happens? What do you normally see? So the show is called Portals to Hell. Great title. But
you know, that's not one like if I were just like looking,
you know,
through,
I know, right?
I wouldn't stop there.
Well, I like Jack Osborne a lot, and he's the guy that's on it. And
gotcha.
So I like Jack Osborne. I think he's really funny. And there's an episode where Katrina is the other girl that's in the show with him.
And you've talked about Kelly's been on there like with her little dog.
That was another, they have a few shows on there, but okay. one of them, it still cracks me up seeing Kelly run. Anyways,
no.
She's like, nope, gone.
That would be me.
That's so funny.
I'd have Shelly under my arm and I'd be like, running. Shelly and I, outie.
So Katrina's sitting in this room and they're like doing an investigation at night. And of course she's like talking out loud and he's like way off in another room watching it.
Mm-hmm.
And because sometimes they'll see like, oh, like, will something happen if it's like Katrina versus Jack? Like, it will something be different? And so they'll
male,
do that.
Male, female.
Yeah, like the energy and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so in one of the episodes, Katrina said, she says something like, oh, I heard that you like to touch women's hair. Like, do you want to touch my hair?
Oh, no.
And Jack, could he... She can't hear Jack. And so Jack goes, oh, Katrina, you are a married woman. But
that's kind of funny.
They did go to the infamous Madame Lawlery house and it was creepy. Real creepy. And they talked to some people who lived there like years and years ago when it was kind of like they turned the house into like apartments almost. They sectioned it off. And, it was very interesting, but the inside of the house is so cool. Like, it's so pretty, and it's just...
Well, I'm sure it's pretty, but... Mm-mm.
I know. It was crazy. But yeah, I saw that, and I was like, I need to remember to say that I did see that episode. And it is good. I have Discovery Plus, so I've been watching a lot of ghost shows because I am who I am.
because me.
Me. Pretty much. This case this week. Well, okay.
She laughs with a smile that, guys, I'm a little frightened.
It is interesting. There's a lot that it is one of those things that as I'm talking about the case, one, this is kind of like a super famous case from that year. Two, we are also going to discuss another case that we just did that's tied into this as well. Yeah. Because it's just insane. And you'll see when we get there in a bit, you'll see why it'll connect back and everything. So let's get to our events. We are now in 1849.
We made it a pretty, that's a lot.
It's 100 when you
years
think about
before
it.
My dad is born.
It's kind of weird when you think of history that way, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, that was not so long ago.
Yeah. I mean, my dad's old, but you know.
But it's still. It's weird.
Yeah.
It's weird. So our first event for the year, January 23rd, Elizabeth Blackwell was awarded her MD by the Medical Institute of Geneva, New York.
A female doctor.
Making her the first female doctor in the United States.
That's awesome. That makes me think of Dr. Quinn, medicine woman. Yeah. Doesn't it?
Yes. January 23rd, again, the U.S. patent was granted for an envelope-making machine to Jesse Park and Cornelius Watson.
Love the name Cornelius.
Park and Watson sound like a law firm.
Yes. Yes, you're right. It does. But I think the next critter I have, I'm going to have to name it Cornelius. That's kind of a fun name.
I like Watson. I would. Sherlock Holmes, but...
Well, sure.
I do. February 4th, well, we've already discussed, first of all, a bit of a throwback. We've already discussed your next cat's name is Purrington.
Well, sure. Polly Purrington.
Polly Purrington.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Making sure that's clear.
If I ever get a corgi, be Cornelius the corgi.
Cornelius the corgi. That is true.
Just saying.
February 4th, the University of Wisconsin began in one room with 20 students.
Wow.
Small college.
I bet they all knew
the
whole school.
February 14th, in New York City, James Knox Polk became the first sitting president of the United States to have his photograph taken.
Ooh.
March 3rd, there are three events on this same day. Minnesota Territory is established.
Mm-hmm.
The United States Department of the Interior was established.
That's not decorating.
Nope. Be cooler if it was.
I'm just being clear.
The U.S. Congress passed the Gold Coinage Act, allowing the minting of gold coins. I'd like to know where some of those are.
And I want to know why they decided it was minting. Like, you know how one word can mean more than one thing and it's spelled the exact same way? Why?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Did you know that the word set in the English language has over 400 definitions?
I mean, why? Well, let's make up a new word.
Yeah. Because you can set a date. You can set something down.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different
Game,
ones.
Game, set, match.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
so interesting, but yeah, I don't know where minting came from.
Yeah, I'm just saying, let's
because it's the U.S. Mint, so I don't know,
but like minty flavor, like
that's what I think.
Mint. Exactly. Yeah. Anyway, okay,
interesting. Words are weird.
English is weird.
Yes. March 4th, Zachary Taylor became the 12th president of the United States, and I just love this name. I don't know why. I think my mouth likes the name. Like, you know how there's like things that like...
The way you say
it. Yeah. Millard Fillmore.
Yes. You know what? Okay. So weird. I was just thinking that there... things just happen. Okay. For some reason, in 11th grade, it was U.S. history.
Mm-hmm.
We had to memorize the presidents in order. I can't do that now. Mm-hmm. Like, I passed it. Yeah. But like... I would land on him, and he was one that, you know, I got to him, and it was Millard Fillmore.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I said it funny, but it was like, you know, I got to him, you know, it was kind of a landing point.
Like,
make sure
a checkpoint.
To get to him exactly, because his name was just so interesting.
It's, I don't know why, but I like it. So
kind of like onomatopoeia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's weird, but So, yes, Millard Fillmore became vice president of the United States, but both refused to be sworn in office on a Sabbath.
Oh.
So they actually did not get sworn in to office until March 5th, the next day, because they refused to do it on Sunday. It's like,
it's not on a Sunday anymore, though, because, I mean, yeah.
Not anymore.
Yeah. Because, I mean, we've watched it. When I taught, we've watched it in school.
And then, let's see, March 10th, Abraham Lincoln, we know him. He applied for a patent, and he is the only U.S. president to apply for a patent, by the way.
I wondered.
And it was for a device that lifted a boat over shoals and obstructions.
Not even Thomas Jefferson?
It's like a boat lift.
Yeah.
That was before the patent office.
Okay, yeah. And I was trying to put that together because I know Thomas Jefferson was, he was before
the patent office. Well, and remember the patent office just burned to the ground.
Well, that's true.
And
that's
nobody knows anything about it, so.
That's
true. As far as documentation goes. Yeah,
because he invented the dumbwaiter.
So, but I think that might have been before
patents. Yeah, I get,
Because we would have talked about it.
Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. I was, you know, something just kind of blipped in me. Yeah. You have those little synapses fire, little things. Beautiful things happen. Yeah.
So then April 10th, the safety pin was patented by Walter Hunt in New York City. He later sold the rights to his patent for $400.
Oh, Walter.
It's like when Manhattan was bought for like, what, a dollar?
I mean, years come ago. On. But Walter, thank you. Because that has saved me so many times. And my modesty thanks you because, you know, like you get a shirt.
Yeah, sometimes they just don't sit right.
And you look down and you go, well, hello there, ladies, you know? And it's like a little inappropriate for where you are or for anywhere. Or anywhere. Yes.
Could be. That's
people are getting an eyeful and they ought not. Yes.
May 3rd, the Mississippi River levee broke.
Uh-oh.
Which was probably the first time New Orleans was flooded.
The first time.
The first time. Oh, probably one of the big first ones. So, that's, you know, levees have never been New Orleans, friend, never, as we know. Ever, so ever, we ever. Discussed that in our episode about Madame Lawlery. Anyways.
Oh, so bad.
I know. May 20th. This one I did a little bit like more of a deepish dive into for this little thing because I almost covered it until we'll see in next week's episode.
Until you found out more things.
About something else.
Okay.
And then I had to text Leah and say, remember how I said we were going to record? Well, and what did I say? Because of who I am.
Yeah, because of who I am as a person.
As a person. I changed the case.
Just kidding.
Like halfway through research of something else. Anyways. So on May 20th, the Astor Place riot occurred in Manhattan. The riot took place at the now demolished Astor Opera House in Manhattan and they didn't have a firm number. It was between 22 and 31 rioters were dead.
Ooh.
And more than 120 people were injured.
Oh my.
It was the deadliest to that date of a number of civic disturbances in Manhattan, which put immigrants and citizens at odds with one another, or they were joining together against the wealthy who controlled the city's police and the state militia. So like it was, there was a series of time, like at this time where there were multiple like little outbreaks happening around the city. And then this was like the deadliest of the accumulation.
Yeah. That's very sad.
Yeah. The riot resulted, The riot resulted in the largest number of civilian casualties due to military action in the United States since the American Revolutionary War.
Ooh.
Yeah. And it led to increased police militarization, riot control training and larger, heavier police batons, which, like, okay.
Yikes.
May 29th, Abraham Lincoln said for the first time, "You can fool some of the people all the time and all of the people some of the time, but you cannot fool all people all of the time."
That's very correct.
Mm-hmm. June 6th, Fort Worth, Texas was founded. June 12th, the gas mask was patented by Lewis Haslett in Louisville, Kentucky.
There you go.
September 1st, the first segment of the Pennsylvania Railroad opened for service. September 13th, Tom McCoy became the first prize fighter in the United States to die in a fight.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
I do not understand boxing. I don't understand the I draw. I don't want to watch people just beat each other up.
No,
I don't.
Not at all.
I understand that some people say that it is a gentleman's sport, or that it is. I mean, you do have to have skill. I will not deny that. You do have to have skill. I get that. I don't enjoy watching people hit each other.
No, I can't. I don't think that's not. Mm-mm.
That's, I'd rather watch football.
September 17th, Harriet Tubman first escaped slavery in Maryland with two of her brothers.
First escaped.
First. Because remember, she kept going back.
I know. That's what I'm saying.
You gotta, just, yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. First escaped.
September 19th, the first commercial laundry was established in Oakland, California. September 29th, the first passenger train service was established.
That's an amazing thing.
It was only a passenger train service. So before this time, it was, if you wanted to take a train, you, like, everything on the train, like, it was cargo and passengers. Mm-hmm. They didn't have one that was just passengers. So yes, that was fun.
Have you ridden on a train?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I like trains.
My first time on a train was when I was in Scotland. That was so cool.
Trains are, I like being on a train. They're fun.
Yes.
October 3rd, Edgar Allan Poe was found delirious in a gutter in Baltimore, Maryland under mysterious circumstances.
Uh-oh.
And it was the last time he was seen in public.
Uh-oh.
November 13th, the Constitution of California was ratified. November 15th, the first poultry show opened in Boston.
Poultry show?
Mm-hmm. Moving on. That was all that there was. Yep.
I want more.
No. That's it.
I mean, like,
just that.
Was it, I saw on,
like, a fancy chicken.
Well, I mean, but on America's Got Talent, they had a chicken that played the piano. Like, was it like show poultry? Did they like, did they groom the poultry? And
maybe so.
I mean, or did they have talent? Did they play instruments? Did they teach them, like, to play guitar strings?
I would like to think it.
Did they dress them in fancy dress?
I would like to think that it was much like Miss America.
Like,
and they,
like, they groomed, yeah, and, like, mm-hmm, made their plumage, mm-hmm, shine, and, like,
you never know.
You had your golden sea brights, your Rhode Island reds.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
I'm saying.
That's what I'm thinking, so.
I need to know more about this poultry show.
December 21st, the first skating club was formed in Philadelphia. Love skating.
Not so good at it.
I love it. It's fun. December.
I didn't say it's not fun. I'm just not good at it.
Oh, well, I mean, we can't all be great. It's fine. December 24th, the first great fire of early San Francisco started at the east side of the plaza. It was the first of 7 fires.
Ooh.
In 2 years.
Oh, my gosh. That's horrible.
Yeah.
Oh, another fire, guys.
Okay. Let's go. You know the drill, guys.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Got another one.
And then our undated event for that year, Pfizer was founded by cousins Charles Pfizer and Charles F. Earhart in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, as a manufacturer of fine chemicals.
Huh. They have now given us.
I know. They've done a whole, like, a whole lot of stuff.
Yeah. But most recently. And
yeah.
Most famously now. COVID shots.
Most well known. Let's see. So on to our case for this week. November 23rd, 1849, Dr. George Parkman missed lunch with his wife in Boston, Massachusetts, and is immediately presumed missing.
Oh, because he missed one lunch?
November 30th, 1849. So 23rd, now to the 30th. A janitor. Sorry, I got to turn this way as I say this.
She's got to see my face. This is going to shock me.
A janitor discovered dismembered body parts. Hold on. Hidden in the laboratory of a professor at Harvard Medical School.
Ooh.
I put this story is a doozy, but not like the really good double doozies from the Great American Cookie Company.
Oh my gosh.
I'm funny. The men.
She says about herself.
So funny.
also humble.
Yes. Delight. the men involved in this case are often described as Brahmin, like a Brahmin bag. You know, like B, yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking of like a bull is what I...
Kind of. That's like a Brahmer.
Spelled the same way? Brahmin?
Brahmin and
bull?
Brahmer?
Brahmin bull?
I don't think so.
Anyway.
And a lot of sources, they're called that depending on the source that you find. And for those who are completely unaware, such as myself... A Brahmin is a socially or culturally superior person, especially a member of the upper class from New England specifically.
Which is why I have a Brahmin bag, by the way.
There's that. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Just saying.
I put, since we are shipping up to Boston, get it? Shipping up to Boston. Dropkick Murphy song. Anyways.
No, I didn't know that. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Sorry.
Since we are shipping up to Boston again this week, we don't have any information. We've covered Boston.
Yeah.
Like, we've covered it. So now you see why, like, this is now going to connect to another case.
Gotcha.
Like, we've been in Boston a lot. A lot. So.
A lot happens there.
A lot.
You could have gone more in depth on the New Kids.
No, I'm good.
You totally could. This was your opportunity.
No, because we have to go into something else. So sorry. I said, but seeing as our case quite literally takes place inside the walls of an Ivy League institution.
Oh, yeah.
It would be
horrible.
It would be a bit of a crime to not dip our toes into Rory Gilmore's dream college, even though she did end up going to Yale. I have opinions. Mm-hmm. We don't have time to discuss them at this moment.
No, we don't,
Lorelai would have just given her her wings and she would have been better off. Anyways, it's fine. Harvard Medical School was founded September 18th of 1782 after Joseph Willard presented a report with plans for a medical school to the president and fellows of Harvard College. The original founding members of the medical school were John Warren, Aaron Dexter, and Benjamin Waterhouse, who I'm pretty sure he comes up again in this case. I know that they talked about him as a professor here at this time, but we've talked about him before. And he is the first doctor to test the smallpox vaccine in the U.S. Remember, he tested it on his own family.
That makes me think of Water Noose from Monsters, Inc.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, continue. Did you maybe think of
It is the third oldest medical school in the United States, and I literally put, because I know that Leah is going to ask, Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons were the two before
well.
It. Yes. Yep. I even typed it. I went, it's the third oldest medical school in the U.S. And I went on and I was continuing to my next sentence. And I went,
where are the first team?
And I was like, I go find the other ones.
I love you. inquiring minds want to know.
The first lectures were held in the basement of Harvard Hall, and students didn't pay tuition. This will come back. They
provided dead bodies. They provided cadavers.
Just wait. I'm telling you. Anyways,
don't tell me I'm right.
I'm not. No, But instead, they would purchase tickets to 5 or 6 lectures at a time. So they didn't pay tuition. They would just be like, oh, this one looks good. And like, take it. And that was how they were doing classes.
Well, okay.
In 1788, the first 2 students graduated. The location of the medical college has...
Wait, stop.
Yeah, 2 students.
So I got these classes. Okay, I got enough tickets to graduate.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. I couldn't find anything else on it. I couldn't find who they were either. I tried, but...
How exactly would that work?
I guess they were just like, yeah, you look like a doctor.
You got enough.
Congrats.
Let me sell your tickets.
Yeah.
Yep. That's enough tickets.
It's enough tickets.
We've punched enough. Yep.
Yep.
You're a doctor.
I mean,
that doesn't give me much confidence.
No, it won't. And just wait. The location of the medical school has changed several times due to the actual medical school not owning or operating a teaching hospital. So like UAB is a teaching hospital. Mm-hmm. And so, and like, for those who are not aware, UAB is like the University of Alabama at Birmingham, but they have a hospital. Like it's a world-renowned hospital, yes. Actually, in downtown Birmingham. Lots of people travel here for treatment.
And they've done some of the first kind surgery.
Of first. Yeah. It's crazy. But because Harvard didn't have that, the medical school has like changed locations a bunch of different times. So Charles William Elliott became Harvard's president in 1869 and found the medical school in the worst condition of any part of the university.
That's encouraging.
He made drastic reforms in the department and raised admission standards, instituted a formal degree program. Well, I put in parentheses, yikes.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, and defined it as a professional school within Harvard University.
I mean, thank you for taking charge and correcting that. Who was in charge before and what was his punishment?
Also, keep in mind the first students graduated in 1788. He did not become the president until 1869.
Who was in charge before? Yeah. What was their punishment?
Right?
Yikes.
These changes are what laid the groundwork for its transformation into one of the leading medical schools in the world. In 1906, the medical school moved to its current location in the Longwood Medical and Academic Area. Harvard not only made its name as a leading medical school and the alma mater of Elle Woods, but it also...
What? Like it's hard?
Like it's hard? Like, oh, I go here. What do you mean you go here? Here. Harvard Law School... I mean, everybody does love Elle Woods.
Look.
I love Elle Woods. Such a good movie.
Everybody look, it's Barbie.
I've seen that movie so many times.
One of my favorites.
It's so many times.
And you know, in her contract, she, Reese Witherspoon, like it was negotiated in her contract. She got to keep her wardrobe.
So a good majority of it she did get to keep. And if you watch the home edit. You not seen this on Netflix? The show The Home Edit, where they go and organize people's houses. Hers is one of the first ones that they do.
I can't watch that because it makes me feel horrible about my house.
No. They organize her Legally Blonde closet.
Oh,
like they go in and organize. It's like, and I don't think it's just her Legally Blonde closet. She has stuff in there from like all of her movies and she goes through it and she's like, this is from this movie and this is from this.
Wow.
And yeah. And they made this like special box for her shoes. Mm-hmm. Like the ones that she like wears to court for the first time. They're like,
don't be tapping your last season Prada shoes at me.
Last season.
He's gay. He's gay.
But yeah, they put them in like this acrylic box in the closet for her.
No, so would like that.
It's really cool. It's great.
Obviously I do love that.
It's a good show.
Very much.
So I do love that show, but Harvard has also been associated with several innovations.
Okay.
And, we will just go through a few of them. Keep in mind, I said a few, and this is a few.
A few, okay.
Yeah.
Lay it on me, sister.
The first use of anesthesia for pain during surgery, the introduction of insulin to the U.S. for diabetes.
That's amazing, by the way.
Mapping the visual system of the brain, development of the first successful chemotherapy for childhood leukemia, development of the first implantable pacemaker, discovery of the cause of preeclampsia, the first successful heart valve surgery and human kidney transplant, the first reattachment of a severed human limb, the development of artificial skin for burn victims, developing tissue culture methods for the polio virus, which then led to the polio vaccine, discovery of the genes that cause Huntington disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, and Alzheimer's, just to name a few.
Wow.
That's a few.
Wow.
There's a much larger list.
Yeah.
Some of them that had words that I didn't even know what they meant. Yeah, and I just skipped
it. These are the ones that everybody is going to recognize. Yes. Yeah. Wow.
It wasn't until 1945, just to make sure that's clear, that the first female students were admitted to the medical university. And even then, it was only to, quote, help male students learn to view women as equals, increase the number of physicians in lower paid specialties typically shunned by men, and replace the weakest third of all men classes with better qualified women. I put, thank you so much for your generosity.
Nice.
Harvard. Like, oh no, we need women because like the men don't do the lower paying specialties. So like we need women to take, to come in so that they can do that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I watch Outlander and the female lead, Claire, when she is in modern times, she, I believe it is Harvard that she goes to. It's one of the Ivy Leagues. I want to say Harvard. And she is a surgeon and she's the only woman. And she, and this is in the 60s.
Yeah. So this was 1945 was when they first allowed females to join.
But this is to be a surgeon.
Yeah.
And like, she's the only female.
Oh,
she faces
just,
a lot of,
just wait till we, wait till, let me give you some statistics.
Oh yeah.
Admission each year is limited for each incoming class, and these spots are extremely selective. How selective, you may ask?
What, like it's hard?
For the class of 2023, 6,815 candidates applied. 227 were admitted, making your chances, assuming you were even qualified, a 3.3% chance that you'll get into Harvard, like to the medical school. Yeah. Imagine that as your chances. 3.3% chance. Insane. So into our case this week, George Parkman was born on February 19th, 1790, into one of Boston's richest families, making him a Boston Brahmin. What they called him everywhere. So everything that they were like, this case between two Boston Brahmin. And I was like, what?
What in the world are you talking about?
So his parents were Samuel Parkman and Sarah Rogers, and he was one of five children total. Yes, too many. Elizabeth, Francis, George, Samuel, and Daniel. So only one girl out of the boys.
I bet she could keep anybody in line.
But technically, young George was one of 11, if you include his half-siblings from his father's first marriage to Sarah Shaw.
Oh,
11 children.
Oh, my.
Yeah. 11. No. Also found it very interesting that both of his wives were Sarah. Anyway.
Keeps things less confusing.
It can be. Parkman was in poor health as a child, and this inspired him to want to pursue medicine later on in life. When he was only 15, he entered Harvard University, in 1809, and it was here that he heard a lecture from the one and only Dr. Benjamin Rush, and that name should sound familiar to you if you listened to episode 3, because Dr. Rush was friends with Dr. James Durham, and the two shared letters back and forth up until Dr. Durham's disappearance in 1802.
We like Dr. Rush.
Yes, we do. He's very kind. Parkman was inspired by, quote, the father of psychology, as Dr. Rush was called, and took an interest in mental health and the state of mental asylums at that time. He ended up in Scotland at the University,
a great place.
At the University of Aberdeen for 2 years to obtain his medical degree. After he returned to Boston, he hopped back on to the USS Constitution.
Ah,
we know where that is.
Yep.
It's in Alabama. Anyways, for those who aren't aware. to head back to Paris to observe two French psychiatrists who were pioneers in humane treatment of mental patients. What a novel idea. Treat mental patients like people.
What?
Insane. in a letter back to his family from Paris, Parkman said, quote, "My first knowledge of the hospital was with the high privilege of its guidance, of its great physician, and of his new illustrious associate. Pennell, who's one of the physicians, received me kindly and inquired with much interest after Benjamin Rush, who had lately written his book on diseases of the mind." So even when he went there, they were like, "Oh, you know Benjamin Rush?
Oh.
What can you tell us?
Yeah.
What about him? Is he a gem like we knew? Okay, got it."
Thanks for confirming.
I know, just wanted to make sure. Parkman returned to the U.S. in 1813, and the War of 1812 called him to join the war efforts, and he, quote, received a commission as a surgeon in a regiment on the 3rd Brigade belonging to the 1st Division of Massachusetts Militia. He began in South Boston and simultaneously served as a physician to the poor. So if they couldn't afford mm-hmm. medical treatment, he would do that.
Well, that makes me happy.
I know. He thought that psychiatric institutions should have a more residential feel where patients could socialize, enjoy hobbies, and have as normal of a life as they could have that their mental like facilities or like faculties would permit. So he was basically saying like,
treat them like people.
If they can do things to, like, let chores them. Almost. Like, if yeah. they can do those things, then let them do them. That was kind of his thing. Like, don't just lock them in a room and leave them. And
duh. It's amazing.
I know. Isn't it? In 1817, he wrote two papers, Remarks on Insanity and the Management of Lunatics. Keep in mind, guys, like, these are the names of them. This is the verbiage right at the time.
Yes.
In an effort to convince the trustees of the Massachusetts General Hospital that he could supervise an asylum they were thinking of opening. He also offered to raise $16,000 for the construction of a full-size institution. Unfortunately, his offer was misinterpreted as a proposal to fully endow the project. The McLean Asylum for the Insane, as it was called, was established, but there was concern that if Parkman held an appointment as a doctor at the institution that he endowed, then there would be concerns about corruption. So they wouldn't let him be a doctor, basically, at the place he helped open.
Well, I mean...
Yeah. So, but he would visit the patients and even bought them an organ for some entertainment.
Oh.
Later, he actually opened up his own mansions with an S.
Plural.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
During cholera and smallpox epidemics for the treatment of patients off-site to try and avoid cross-contamination in the asylum. So he opened up his houses, like his houses, mansions, as like second hospitals. So that when the patients were sick with these, like,
very contagious things,
they could move them there and get treatment. And then when they were well, they would go back. So he, like, provided them a space so that they could do that.
That's awesome.
He's kind of a great guy.
He is very much, he's very much learned from his mentor.
Yes, yes. Even though Dr. George Parkman was wealthy, he never showed it on the outside. He didn't even own a horse, and he was known to walk around the streets of Boston routinely and daily to get where he needed to go.
Huh. He was in good physical condition.
Yes. He was tall, thin, and always wore a top hat. Quote, "He abstained while others indulged. He walked while others rode. He worked while others slept. It was a quote from one of his friends. That is, and then the wife of poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Fanny, called Parkman, quote, called Parkman, quote, the lean doctor and the good-natured Don Quixote.
Aww.
Yes. You know what? Come back as well. The Longfellow, like, they're a part of this story, which is weird. I didn't expect to see them in here, but they were apparently friends.
Interesting. But, you know, to have somebody quote, be quoted to say something so kind about you, that is awesome. I mean, to have made such an impact that someone had such kind words to say about you, that's awesome.
I know.
That's amazing.
I know. And when you see more.
Yeah, more than one person.
Well, yeah, but when we get further into this as well, when you see more of this story, it's like further cemented how much, like.
He wasn't just doing some things for show. Mm-hmm. Like, he truly was a kind person, is what this is showing. Mm-hmm. Like, his actions lined up.
Oh, trust me, you will see plenty of that.
Well, that makes me happy.
On the other side of this case, we have John White Webster. He was born May 20th of 1793 into another wealthy Boston merchant family, also a Boston Brahmin. As a child, he was described one of these words you like, and I was laughing when I was typing it out because I know it's a word. It's one of those words that
it's fun to say.
You've used, and it makes me laugh. As a child, he was described as indulged and pampered with a fussy and petulant attitude, but also kind in nature. He graduated from Harvard Medical School in 1815 and went to London right after to continue his studies. While in London, he was a student of surgery and then went to Portugal to practice medicine, publish a book, and meet his wife.
Portugal.
When he arrived back in Boston, he decided to pursue private practice, but he wasn't super successful. So he decided to change careers. By 1824, Webster was a lecturer of chemistry and mineralogy at Harvard. Interesting, huh? Many of Webster's classroom demonstrations involved some of the latest chemical discoveries. It was known that his lectures were tedious, especially for anyone who dared to take it if they were a non-chemistry major.
Oh, dear.
So basically, like, don't even try. Many anecdotes suggested his classroom demonstrations were livened by pyrotechnic drama.
Ooh.
And on one occasion, the president of Harvard warned that some of them were dangerous if an accident were to occur. Webster was described by some as, quote, pleasant in the lecture room, rather nervous and excitable, then by others as, quote, tolerated rather than respected, and has only retained his position on account of its comparative insignificance. As a lecturer, he was dull and commonplace, and while the students took tickets to his lectures, they did not generally attend them.
Oh. Wow.
Yikes. It was discovered around this time that Webster had some financial problems and actually had to give up his family mansion that he had built in Cambridge.
Oh, dear.
The family was leasing a nice home, but it was not anywhere near as nice as the mansion that they had before. He was in debt.
They didn't own it. No. They leased it.
Mm-hmm. He was in debt to several people, and lecturing at Harvard didn't necessarily pay very well either. His friends described Webster as odd. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow said he was a bit macabre. And Longfellow's example of that behavior was a dinner at Webster's house where, quote, the host amazed his guests by lowering the lights, fitting a noose around his own neck, and lolling his head forward, tongue protruding over a bowl of blazing chemicals, to give a ghastly imitation of a man being hanged.
Why in the world would you do that?
There was no explanation. So there is one more man that we need to introduce. And that is Ephraim Littlefield.
I love that name. We've heard the name Ephraim in several cases. Mm-hmm. I love that name.
He was just a regular guy who was referred to in many sources. If we had Boston Brahmin, well, we also have what they all referred to as a swamp Yankee. Mm-hmm. So basically someone who is a Yankee, from everything that I read, they are a Yankee, but they're like country. So they called them swamp Yankees.
It's kind of like the term.
I don't know how I feel about it. So I don't.
It's kind of like the term used in Louisiana.
Yeah. So it's weird. Anyways, he was a janitor at the School of Medicine and actually lived in the basement of the college with his wife, Caroline, at the time of our case.
Lived in the basement of the school.
Of the school. Okay. Yeah, because he was a janitor. He was kind of like the caretaker of the building.
Okay.
And we'll see more of that.
And we have to remember that it's not the school like we would think of schools now. Like,
right.
The buildings are more like.
Right.
Nicer.
They're like houses with classrooms. Like, that's kind of how they are. Yeah. So John Webster's laboratory was right next to the basement apartment, and the two knew each other quite well. Littlefield cleaned the doctor's rooms and labs. He started fires in the rooms for classes. He set up any lab specimens that were needed and pretty much anything else. While he was technically a janitor, he's kind of more like a TA from what I can tell. Like, he does clean the building and he's also like a caretaker, but he's also a TA, and like he would do everything in the classrooms to get them all set up for them.
Right.
And
like a building manager.
Yeah. If Harvard professors didn't make that much money, then you can imagine that the janitor made much less than that. And to get a little extra money, Littlefield would obtain cadavers for around $25 per body. It didn't say how, but then he would sell them to the students and professors. And I put, kind of like if Matilda's dad sold bodies instead of cars. Regardless.
Daddy, you're a crook.
Yeah. Regardless, he was well known in the department, and even though many might not have taken time to pay attention to him, he was always aware of everyone else.
Dun, dun, dun.
Our case begins before it begins, if that makes any sense, because it all started when John Webster borrowed $400 from George Parkman in 1842, around $12,000 today.
Pocket change.
Yeah. Then 5 years later, so 5 years later, Webster requested a larger loan from Parkman. Keep in mind, he had barely paid back any of the $400 that he already borrowed.
I was going to ask, had he repaid the
barely,
loan?
Like hardly at all. Total, he would have borrowed $2,432, which today would be around $72,000.
Whoa.
With this new loan and the balance owed on the old one, that would be the total amount. Parkman secured this loan with a mortgage on Webster's personal property. By the next year, Webster wasn't doing much better and asked another friend, Robert Shaw, if he could borrow $12,000. And he also put up collateral for this loan. But it was the same collateral that he put up for the loan with Parkman, which, like, you can't do.
Yeah.
Like, it's not,
And it already is earmarked for somebody else, mm-hmm. Bubba.
On November 22nd of 1849, Parkman took a stroll over to Cambridge to look for Webster, but he wasn't able to find him. And I am so funny. Instead, Parkman went to Harvard's bursar. And I just put in parentheses, you punched the bursar? Yes. Yes. I made sure because they put Harvard's cashier.
You're like, no,
I intentionally that's put bursar.
Absolutely. Of course you did, because you,
I may have punched him. It's a blur. Sir. He handles the financials. You punched the bursar. Yes.
I wanted to do what you did.
I mean,
to
enjoy the road. He looked at me like I was stupid. I'm not stupid. Just saying. Anyways. And he asked for the money from the sale of Webster's lecture tickets to try and repay back some of the debt. The next day, Webster visited Parkman at his house and suggested that they meet later that day at the medical school around 1:30. Parkman was last seen alive entering the college on North Grove Street at 1:45 p.m. on November 23rd. He was wearing a dark frock coat, dark trousers, a purple satin vest, and a top hat.
Purple satin vest?
I know. Fancy. I like him. He's fancy. Yes. So, later that afternoon, our favorite janitor slash TA slash corpse reseller, Ephraim Littlefield, found Webster's rooms locked from the inside. He could hear water running on the other side of the door. Webster was home by 6 p.m. that day to attend a party at the Treadwells' house, and he didn't really seem distressed in any way. Meanwhile, over at the Parkman house, panic was setting in. If there was one constant in this world, it was that Dr. George Parkman was a predictable man, and he had lunch with his wife every day.
Wow.
He did not show up for lunch, and she immediately knew something was wrong.
Wow.
Yes. Which was just kind of one of those things of like, she didn't even think like, well, maybe he's just late. He doesn't show up, and she's like, he's dead. He's dead. He's gone. I don't know where he's done. He's not here.
Call the police.
Call
the dogs.
Immediately. She just like
find him.
Went 0 to 100.
Play.
Yeah. Mm-mm. she knew it by her watch. She was looking at that door.
He gone.
It's 2:01. He's not there. She's like, he's dead. He's dead.
He
I don't know
gone,
what
y'all.
To tell you.
Called Popo.
Yeah. Immediately. She was like, nope. But on November 23rd, like I said, he missed lunch. By the morning of November 24th, the Parkman family knew something was wrong, and they started asking everyone if they knew where George could be and contacted the police. Oddly enough, our favorite janitor TA corpse seller, Littlefield, saw Webster with a bundle under his arms in the medical school, and Webster told Littlefield to start a fire. By November 25th, Webster had been questioned, had been seen, had, whoop, 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 nope. I can't speak, apparently. Oh, Webster was seen being questioned outside of the college with Parkman's nephew, James Henry Blake, and a police officer. That afternoon, Webster also paid a visit to Parkman's brother, the Reverend Francis Parkman, to casually inform him that he had met with Dr. George Parkman after Webster had obtained $483.64 to pay a debt installment. Okay. Webster claimed that Parkman promised to go right away to have the payment recorded by the city clerk and to clear the debt. Webster then left the reverend's house without even asking how the search was going or even offering help.
Oh.
Just dropped by to let him know that debt, I paid it the day your brother went missing. That's neither here nor there. But he did say he was going to the city clerk's office to like wipe that debt clean. So I just want to make sure that that is on record. That is all. Goodbye.
Okay, see you. Bye.
Just in case you were wondering, just in case, I just thought it could be helpful, but I don't owe you any money. So
that's all, no suspicions.
That's it. Like,
don't follow me.
Okay.
No more questions.
I mean, all right.
That was not well
planned. No. By November 26th, a $3,000 reward was being advertised for finding Parkman alive. That's $90,000 today.
But to find him alive.
Yes. And $1,000 if his body were found. So they're like, we don't care. We'll give you something either way.
Mm.
We prefer him alive.
It's more if he's alive.
But yeah, so $90,000 if he is alive, $30,000 if his
not.
Body is found.
Yes. Well, never mind.
Yeah.
That was going to be.
Roughly 20.
How much for his leg?
I mean, do we? Oh, God. You don't know where this is going. I forget. Roughly 28,000 missing notices were printed, posted, and passed out around Boston. 28,000.
Wow.
Yeah. On the evening of November 27th, Webster was seen working at the college. The city was buzzing with gossip about what could have happened to Parkman. The rumors ranged from blaming Irish immigrants, robbery, or that Parkman...
Blaming Irish immigrants.
Specifically... Irish immigrants. I mean, it is Boston, so. Or that Parkman had simply ran away. Unsigned letters were arriving at the police station proposing various scenarios of what could have happened, presumably trying to collect the reward money. The Charles River and Boston Harbor were dragged to try and find a body. I put, okay, but like how many did they find?
Because there's say not the same none. Thing. Like, what there's did they not come up none. With? I want to know what they found.
They didn't
What
say.
Did they find?
Yeah.
What did they find?
And men were sent to neighboring towns to inquire about Parkman. Search parties were formed that day. And yeah, the day that everything occurred, like they set up search parties, but then they formed search parties, like day parties and night parties. So like you had to like mm-hmm. you, they were searching at all times.
Like 24 hours.
24 hours. Yeah. So, which is just
And they didn't have
crazy.
Helicopters back Mm-mm. then.
The police searched Parkman's buildings, both rented and vacant. He had a few properties around town. So,
well, I mean, he had multiple mansions.
Yeah. So he would go around, like, that was how they kind of knew his routine. He would go around mm-hmm. and, like, just see the properties and, like, make sure they were yeah. good and collect any rent or anything that was due. So, yes, they went to all of his buildings, both rented and vacant, and even abandoned buildings that he didn't own. Durastus Clapp.
That is
yep. He is the head of the first city detective bureau in the United States in Boston. Thought it was interesting. 1828 is when he became that. Him and other officers searched the medical school. They returned once each time, placing special emphasis on the laboratories and dissecting vaults, but they never found anything to indicate that Parkman had been there. Our favorite janitor TA corpse reseller, you know him, mm-hmm. Littlefield, was getting anxious because his name had been brought up in relation to Parkman's disappearance. And it was noted that Webster started acting very odd.
More odd than normal.
Yes.
Because,
yes. Yeah. A few days after the disappearance, Littlefield and Webster met in the street. And Webster asked Littlefield if he had seen Parkman at the medical school the previous week. Littlefield said he had. On Friday, around 1:30, and Webster struck his cane on the ground and asked him again if he had seen Parkman anywhere in the building, if he had seen him after 1:30, or if Littlefield had seen Parkman in Webster's lecture room. Littlefield again answered no to all of these questions. Then apparently Webster thought this was a really good time to repeat his entire story about paying off the debt he owed Parkman and walked off. All right.
So this safe yeah. to just to okay, let you know. Yeah, I'm going to tell him too.
Yeah. Littlefield interacted with Webster again when Webster asked our favorite janitor, TA corpse reseller, a ton of questions about the dissecting vaults. Then, after the medical school had been searched for the last time before Thanksgiving, Webster gave Littlefield's family a turkey as a gift.
It's very kind.
Webster had never given him any gifts before. And in fact, this was the most they had ever talked. Ever. So,
you know, people change.
You know. Webster arrived suspiciously early to the medical school on November 28th. Littlefield was watching Webster walk back and forth across his office from the furnace to the fuel closet and back. He did this 8 times. And then later that day, the furnace was burning so hot that heat could be felt through the other side of the wall.
Oh, my.
All of the doors to the office were locked, and later in the day, when Webster was gone, I put Littlefield added sleuth to his list of jobs as he climbed through the window into Webster's office. He found the kindling barrels nearly empty, even though Littlefield knew he had recently filled them. And they were wet. There were wet spots that tasted like acid in odd places. I put no word as to how he found out it tasted like acid.
I mean, yeah, because my finger went up as soon as you said taste. Yeah. And I was like, wait a minute. You just going to just like taste just some random wet spots?
I guess so.
Because, I mean,
it was very interesting. So I don't know. But then on Thanksgiving, I put our favorite janitor, TA corpse reseller, sleuth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm glad you added sleuth. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He needs, I mean, respect needs to be paid for it.
Jack of all trades.
Yes. as we know. He borrowed a hatchet, drill, crowbar, and mortar chisel from the medical school. His wife was acting as a lookout. I love how Caroline was just behind to like,
I got you, bro.
She's the lookout, yeah. Like popping around and stuff. So this was on Thanksgiving. Keep this in mind. His wife was acting as a lookout as he started chiseling away at the wall under Webster's private lab.
Oh, no.
He went down a tunnel into the vault where the wall had felt hot and began to bang on it where the privy emptied into a pit that the police had not searched. Mm-hmm. For those who are not aware, a privy is a toilet. He dug through two layers of brick in just over an hour, but then he stopped to go to a dance because priorities.
I mean, like, we can't.
Caroline was like, okay, we got to go. We have plans. So let's wrap it up.
You promised you'd dance with
me. We promised. This is Thanksgiving. We are going to a dance.
You're going to wear your nice clothes. I've ironed them. I've laid them out. You never dress up for me. You never take me out anymore.
And so he was like, you know what? I got to go.
That's right.
On November 30th, Littlefield resumed chiseling until he managed to punch a hole into the wall. He felt a draft so strong that it did not permit his lantern to stay lit inside. Finally, he saw something odd. He narrowed his eyes and looked more sharply until he just made out the top of a dirt mound, and it was the shape of a human pelvis. He then looked over and saw a dismembered thigh and the lower part of a leg, which is why it was hilarious that you said, but how much for a leg? And I was like, oh, no. Yeah.
We are so in sync. I mean, we don't even know how in sync we are.
Yeah, that's what I was like. Oh, that's why I said, oh, you don't know where this is going. I forget. So, yeah, they found part of his leg. Littlefield ran to report what he had seen to another professor. Sorry, I forget what I write sometimes. But to report what he had seen to another professor, Jacob Bigelow, and I put Harvard Medical School Gigolo, and I just put, I'm sorry.
This is the movie.
I apologize to myself. I just put, I'm sorry. Harvard Medical School Gigolo.
Oh, my gosh.
Anyway.
Were you?
No, I wasn't. No.
It was just late.
Yeah, it was, actually. The two went to let the detectives know what they had found, and by the time they arrived back at the school, a crowd had gathered. They had Littlefield go through the dissection room and inventory the specimens to make sure that none of them were missing, like the corpses.
Well, sure, because it's the medical school and exactly. You know, you're going to have cadavers.
Then several men went into the tunnel and moved toward the vault. They decided that the man with the longest arms would go into the privy and hand out the remains.
I would not be that person because I am short.
But I'm sure he was thrilled to have the honor.
No, my arms are really, really short. You are mistaken. Yep,
sorry. He handed out the pelvis, the right thigh, and the lower left leg. These were placed on a board to await the arrival of the coroner. Three officers arrived at John White Webster's door. They took him to jail on a charge of murder. Webster denied knowledge of any crime when he was told what our favorite janitor TA corpse reseller sleuth found. He exclaimed, "That villain, I am a ruined man."
That villain.
Webster went on to blame our new best friend Littlefield with the crime and mentioned that only the two of them had access to the area that the remains were found in. He then fell silent, sitting in his cell, trembling and sweating.
With anger, I'm sure.
He put what he later admitted to be strychnine into his mouth, but to Webster's dismay, rather than kill him, it just made him extremely sick in a jail cell.
Oh, no.
For anybody who's doesn't know, strychnine poisoning might sound familiar, but a lot of people might not know exactly what it is. It can be fatal to humans and other animals and can occur by, like, you can inhale it, swallow it, or, like, absorption through your eyes or mouth.
Ooh.
Yeah. It produces some of the most dramatic and painful symptoms of any known toxic reaction, making it quite noticeable and a common choice for assassins and poison attacks. For this reason, strychnine poisoning is often portrayed in literature and film, such as the murder mysteries written by Agatha Christie.
Mm.
There is no specific antidote for strychnine. Quote, the convulsions are often triggered by stimuli. When your body senses something, neurons want to fire. And if they aren't, controlled seizures occur. So patients are generally kept in quiet, dark rooms. Treatment of strychnine poisoning involves an oral application of an activated charcoal infusion, which serves to absorb any poison within the digestive tract that has not yet been absorbed into the blood. Anticonvulsants such as phenobarbital, which is luminol. And I put Q, the master of disguise, which Leah has not seen. We don't have time to talk about it.
She's disappointed in me, and I'm in the box of shame.
Yes. I put, it might have a 1% on Rotten Tomatoes, but I call that hogwash. So,
well, I told her I didn't watch it because it looked stupid to me.
Am I not turtly enough for the turtle club? He's in like a turtle outfit because they're going to like this. It's called the turtle club, but it's not because of turtles. Like, it's just like for super wealthy people. And so he shows up in this costume of a turtle, and the guy goes, I'm sorry, sir, we cannot let you in. And he goes, I'm not turtly enough for the turtle club. Turtle.
I'm so sorry.
But luminol, the reason he like was really good at copying people. And so anytime I see the word luminol part of the movie, he's like, when he was a kid, he was copying his chemistry professor. And so anytime I think of it, I think of an ad, just a little bit of luminol, and then everything explodes. They also use diazepam, which is Valium, to control the convulsions, along with muscle relaxants such as dantrolene to combat muscle rigidity. If the patient survives the initial 24 hours, then recovery is highly probable. And I put, so obviously, if you're trying to poison yourself in prison, you're innocent, right?
Obviously. Okay.
On December 1st, a coroner's jury was assembled. Before the jury was let into the area, the coroner and marshal's men examined a sink that appeared to be recently gouged in several places.
Oh.
They then noticed that the strange acid stains on the floor remained as well. They were also on the steps, as well as the contents of the furnace.
Mm.
In the furnace, they extracted a button, some coins, more bone fragments, including a jawbone with teeth. They dumped out a chest from which came a foul odor, and there was an armless, headless, hairy, and partially burned torso.
Ugh.
Oh my God, I forgot about this part. Okay, sorry. Just as they determined that the head had been sawn off, they found a saw.
Oh no.
Yeah, they found a saw nearby. Then they found a thigh stuffed inside the torso.
Oh.
And the heart and the other organs were missing.
Oh. Ew. No.
I put WTD, what the duck, because I can't say the other. Anyways, Miss Parkman, this is what I said. Oh, I forgot about this. Miss Parkman identified the body as her husband's. You do not want to have children hear specific body part words. Skip forward now.
Oh, no.
She identified her husband's body from markings near his penis. And I put, ayo.
Wow.
And on his lower back.
Wow. I knew where you were going.
I forgot about that. That's funny.
Yep. That's him.
I mean, you go, Miss Parkman. And Fine. Parkman's brother-in-law said that he had seen the extreme hairiness of Parkman's body and confirmed that the body was definitely his. Subsequent searches turned up bloody clothing belonging to Webster, as well as a right kidney. Just the right one.
Just the right one.
Testing on the stains showed them to be copper nitrate, which is a substance effective for removing blood. Since they were already at a medical college with good facilities for examination of a body, they laid out the parts, tested them, and wrote thorough descriptions. They found that a hole underneath the left breast might have been the stab that killed the victim, although it did not resemble a wound and there was no blood. By the end of the day, they had estimated that a man's height to have been around 5'10", which was a match to Dr. George Parkman. After Webster's arrest, the town elite were determined that one of their own could not be guilty of such a crime.
Well, heavens no.
Henry
Wadsworth. Must have been some Irishman.
Must have been. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's wife, Fanny, our friend, wrote, quote, "Boston is at this moment in sad suspense about the fate of poor Dr. Parkman. You will see by the papers what dark horror overshadows us like an eclipse. Of course, we cannot believe Dr. Webster guilty, bad as the evidence looks. Many suspect the janitor, who is known to be a bad man, to have wished for a reward offered for Dr. Parkman's body. He could make things appear against the doctor, having bodies under his control. I trust our minds will soon be relieved, but meanwhile, they are soiled by new details continually. I went to see poor Miss Webster on Saturday, the day after her husband's arrest, but of course I was not admitted. What a terrible blight upon her life that, and that of the girls. The mere suspicion, for I cannot believe anything could be provided." So, as you see, other people were also saying, like, maybe the janitor did it. Like,
yeah, and they said there was going to be money, and you know that he'd love to have some money.
Well, she was saying he inquired about collecting the reward, and so they thought that that was suspicious. But I'm like, yeah. But he found the body.
I mean. He found it. You said so, you'd get some money. Yeah. So.
Harvard librarian John Langdon Sibley wrote in his journal, quote, "The standing of Dr. Webster, his uniform tenor of conduct since the disappearance of Dr. Parkman, his artlessness and unfamiliarity with the crime of any kind has been such that the excitement, the melancholy, the aghastness of everybody are indescribable. The professors, at the mere suspicion that he is guilty, people cannot eat. They feel sick." On December 6th, thousands lined the streets for Dr. George Parkman's funeral. And for those who think fascination with true crime is recent, over 5,000 people toured the crime scene.
Toured the crime scene?
Yes. John White Webster was indicted for murder on January 26th of 1850. Daniel Webster, I put no relation, but we know him. And Rufus Choate, I put, you know, the one who made sleepwalking an excuse for murder. Refused to serve as defense attorneys in the case.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. While John White Webster was awaiting trial, he wrote a 194-page defense for himself. Webster did not discuss strategy with the attorneys he ended up picking.
Or settling for, yeah. Because nobody wanted to take it.
Exactly. He instead handed them the defense he had written in jail. Neither attorney cross-examined Littlefield, you know, our best friend and janitor, about his
sleuth.
Yeah. Neither one cross-examined Littlefield about his corpse selling.
Mm.
And they never pushed the information that the janitor lived near the lab, which in theory would have given him an opportunity to plant the body parts and collect a reward.
Mm-hmm.
The trial finally began on March 19th of 1850 and ran for 12 days. 60,000 people witnessed portions of the trial.
Wow.
They were given tickets and the spectators were quickly rotated through the trial as it went on like a merry-go-round. Like there would be a group, you would sit there for like 30 minutes and then they'd get up, next group would come in and sit down. Like,
but I mean, that's like the trials that are on TV now. Mm-hmm. They didn't have TV then.
Yeah, so 60,000 people.
Wow.
Witnessed the trial. Yeah. Journalists came from as far as London, Paris, and Berlin. Webster pleaded not guilty.
Of course he did. Mm-hmm.
Our favorite janitor, TA corpse reseller Sleuth, was called to testify. He told how Parkman demanded payment on November 19th, how Webster had asked if anyone could use a light inside the dissecting room vault, how Webster began locking his rooms, and about the turkey that his family was gifted. Oh, but finally, about the heat on the walls that led him to dig in the area where the body was found in the first place. The defense accused Littlefield of being after the reward, but they never accused him of the murder.
Ah.
The defense gave a 6-hour long closing argument.
Oh my gosh.
On 4 key points that the prosecution had to prove. They had to prove that the body was Parkman's, that a homicide had actually occurred, that Webster had perpetrated it, and that he had done so with malice forethought. The defense claimed that since Parkman had been seen leaving the medical school on Friday afternoon, the prosecution's case was false, and that even if the body was Parkman's, anyone could have killed and disposed of his body where it was found. Webster took the stand against his attorney's advice, and in a 15-minute speech, he criticized his own attorneys and presented his own version of the evidence.
What?
Because that'll work.
A smart mm-hmm. guy.
Mm-hmm. Finally, it came time to make a decision, and the judge said the jury only needed to find beyond a reasonable doubt that the remains were George Parkman's. At this time, the standard in murder cases was proof to absolute certainty that the dead body was that of the victim. So, like, that was the main thing you had to prove in those cases at that time. So that was why he brought that up. After a deliberation, the jury voted unanimously that the remains were Parkman's, that Webster had killed him, and that he had done so deliberately. They returned just 2 hours and 45 minutes after they left the courtroom, stating that they had reached a verdict.
I'm surprised it took that long.
Yeah. The crowd filtered back in and Webster was led inside. John White Webster was found guilty of the murder of Dr. George Parkman. Quote, the prisoner who upon the sentence of the jury had turned deadly pale, but who had stood up with a firm bearing to receive the verdict of the jury.
Something.
Yep. Immediately upon its announcement, grasped the rail in front of him and slowly sank down into his seat. Dropping his head, he rubbed his eyes beneath his spectacles with a trembling and convulsed motion as if to wipe away tears and remained in that position a few moments. Webster was sentenced to be hanged by the neck until death. There were mixed reactions around Boston. The Evening Bulletin wrote, quote, scarcely one man in 10,000 can be found who does not agree with us in the opinion that the evidence for the defense was sufficient to create a doubt of the unhappy man's guilt. While the Massachusetts Plowman claimed, quote, we have scarcely met a man of intelligence since the evidence has all come out who did not profess to believe in Webster's guilt. On May 4th, Webster's lawyers submitted a petition for a writ of error against the judge, Lemuel Shaw. Remember Herman Melville's father-in-law?
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, remember that was in Washington Goods, Kate. Keep this in mind because it comes back. The hearing was held before Shaw and his 4 associates on June 12th, and the writ was denied.
Yeah.
Webster appealed to the governor for a pardon. The governor did not want to be seen as someone who bowed to the will of the wealthy elite. And just the year before, our friend Washington from 2 episodes ago, who, remember, was the black sailor who had been hanged for the murder of a fellow sailor based on circumstantial evidence, to have pardoned Webster after sending Washington to the gallows would have under mind the governor's reputation.
Mm.
The Fall River Weekly News, we know Fall River, talked about them as well. Quote, if any delays, misgivings, or symptoms of mercy are manifested, the body of Washington Goode will be paraded before the mind's eye of His Excellency. If he relents in this case, though the entire population of the state petition for a remission of sentence, Governor Briggs will forfeit all claim to the public respect as high-minded, honorable, and an impartial chief magistrate. He can do one of two things and retain his character as a man and a public servant. Resign his office or let the law take its course. So basically, like, you do not have a leg to stand on.
Yeah, yeah.
You think of how many thousands of signatures they gathered to try and get his sentence commuted, and the governor was still like, nope, still going to sentence him to be hanged. And now the next year, you're going to just kind of think, oh, maybe we don't do it for this one. And this one, like, the evidence is overwhelming. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. In June, Webster wrote out a full confession. He admitted to killing Parkman in, quote, self-defense.
Mm-hmm. Funny how he changes his tune.
Right. When Parkman had become aggressive over the debt.
That doesn't really sound like anything that matches what we have heard.
No. Webster said that it was unpremeditated rage and an act of passion, not a malicious murder. Webster said that Parkman, quote, was speaking and gesticulating in the most violent and menacing manner. John White Webster was taken to Boston's Leverett Street Jail on August 30th, 1850, and publicly hanged. He died within 4 minutes and was buried in the Coops Hill Burying Ground. After the hanging, George Parkman's widow was the, this is right after the hanging. Keep this in mind. She was the first to contribute to a fund that was created for Webster's widow and daughters.
Wow.
The first one to give them money after he died.
If that doesn't speak of someone's character.
Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, they had already gotten $72,000 in loans from them. Well, not the wives or anything, but, and she still gave them money. Like, so it clearly was not about the money. Like, and he let him borrow money for 5 years without paying hardly any of it back. And then had the gall in one pocket and the audacity in the other to come and ask for more money when he had barely, and Parkman was like, yeah, okay. So, okay. You know, it's just.
Well, I mean, some people, they just, they feel entitled.
Yeah, it's insane. This case has become infamous. And even when Charles Dickens visited Boston in 1867, one of his first requests was to see the room where Parkman had been murdered.
Oh my.
However, this case isn't just infamous.
Oh, dear.
It also claims two firsts in U.S. history.
Okay. What are they?
The Parkman-Webster case is the first in the U.S. that dental evidence was allowed in the trial.
Oh, cool. Well, I heard you say that there was that a found his job in teeth, and I wondered.
And that scientific testimony was accepted as evidence in a murder trial.
Well, I mean, because of where it happened. Mm-hmm. And so,
testimony as evidence.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm. It was very cool. So, you would think that's where the case ends.
Oh, dear.
But it doesn't.
What now?
The George Parkman house still stands today.
Oh.
And due to Parkman's tragic and unsettling end, many believe that Parkman's soul was unable to pass on.
Oh, dear.
Leaving his spirit to venture back home where it has remained ever since.
He was kind.
The stunning townhouse is equally as beautiful to this day. Trust me.
Uh-huh.
It sold recently and I saw the photos for the listing. Oh, my gosh. It is gorgeous. Like, oh, so pretty. And they did the good thing in buying an old house where like they did update some things, but it still like holds all of the charm. Yeah. Ugh, it's so pretty.
It makes me so sad when people buy an old home and they want to make it a new home. Like either you want a new home or you want an old home. Like, you know, update things that need to be updated, yes, but keep that character of it being an old home.
This was from the listing. I found this in the listing portion. The brick facade and front porch pillars are perfectly reminiscent of the architecture of the time. The soaring windows fill the space with light. The iconic spiral staircase makes for an impressive entryway. And it is one that it like sweeps up the wall.
Oh, it's so gorgeous.
In 1999.
You can't not sing that.
A broken toilet flooded all three stories of the historic house, damaging a large portion of the structure. Oddly enough, are you ready for this?
I don't know.
The accident occurred on November 23rd, the day Parkman was murdered, 150 years exactly earlier.
That's kind of cool. And he
do you see my arm?
Like he was like shoved down a pretty.
Yeah, and he was So that's why they're like, no, it is. No, it there's something here. Like 150 years. Yeah, 150 years to the day it broke, flooded the whole house.
And he was shoved down a privy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean,
so let's see. Oh, if we're going to go by haunting standards, if anything were haunted, it would most likely be the crime scene. But this room doesn't exist anymore.
It was torn down.
And it is believed that it was filled in sometime during the early 1900s. The George Parkman House is located at 8 Beacon Street in Boston. However, today it is a private residence valued at over $6 million.
Ooh, mercy.
And it is gorgeous.
Well,
oh, so pretty. So that is the Parkman Webster case, AKA the Harvard murder case.
And you know, I'm very glad, very glad that you touched on the fact that, you know, the judge was, you know, he asked for an appeal and the judge didn't give that. But, you know, and he really was banking on, like, he didn't think he was going to go to jail because of who he was and who he knew and all
exactly.
that. And that the elite at that time, they really thought that they were untouchable. They were raised to think that they were untouchable. They were the law. They were above the law. And, you know, because they knew so many people, they were able to get away with so much and, you know, were so corrupt.
Exactly.
I'm so thankful that, you know, they were like, no, enough is enough. Like, you did this. Don't you can't put it on the janitor. It was not some Irish immigrants. Like, you didn't manage your money. You lost your fancy house. He probably told you, no, I'm not giving you any more money. And you were petulant. Yes, petulant. I said it. And you got mad because he said, hey, I've already given you a lot of money. You've not managed that. I'm cutting you off. I'm not going to be
like, I'm not your piggy bank.
Exactly. I'm sorry. I've done well. You have not. I'm your friend. I wish you well. You know, I don't wish any harm for you, but I'm not just going to keep giving you money every couple of years and float you. By the way, I heard that you got to try to get another loan using the
You did get another loan.
Using the same collateral.
And put up the same collateral.
Dude, you can't, you know.
You can't do that.
That's not cool. You can't do that. So there was a confrontation. I'm sure there was a confrontation. You know, but you messed up. And guess what? You have to face consequences for your actions. You're not above the law. You're not better than anybody else. Last I checked, you put your pants on one leg at a time, just like everybody else. And that's, you know, people, especially at that time, there was such a large gap in classes that, you know, they really thought they were above the law. And they were treated that way.
A lot of time, yeah, they were. And I think too, the volume of people who came out to try and find Parkman.
Right.
I think that spoke to a lot of it as well, because it was like,
made sure that it did stick.
Yeah. It was kind of like, yeah, there were people on both sides that were like, well, I don't know if he did it. I don't know, you know, things back and forth, but it also just like speaks to character when so many people, like, I know he was wealthy and I understand that. And I know like there's a whole underlying issue with people being more concerned with like people who are more wealthy or are a different mm-hmm. race than another, like being focused on for cases. But like right. people were shocked that Parkman was dead. Like they were genuinely right. like,
they were sad.
Yeah.
They very missed sad. Him because mm-hmm. he was so well known mm-hmm. for doing so many good things.
I know. And it's like, how many more things could he have done?
Right.
Like, which is so
and
just.
He genuinely cared about people. Mm-hmm. And
I mean, who opens their houses?
Right.
Houses to mental patients who are dealing with cholera and smallpox.
Right.
Like, people don't do, you don't think of, oh, how can I help? I'll just let him have the houses.
And his wife knew what? That something was wrong because he missed his lunch with her that mm-hmm. he made sure to keep with all the other things that he had going on.
They could have had some other lunch plans that day. I'm just saying, we know how his body was identified, and I'm just saying.
Well, I mean,
I'm just saying.
They may have had a snack after day snack. But obviously, it wasn't just a marriage of convenience, too. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he was obviously very committed with that as well. So, I mean, this speaks, yeah. All the things that we've seen and we've heard, it speaks of his character.
And for his wife to then give money to the family mm-hmm. of the man who murdered her husband.
Right. But she knew that it wasn't.
She did. Them. But a lot of people would not think of it that way.
Oh, sure. They would just give them the cut direct yep. and just go on with their life because it, you
yeah,
know,
exactly.
Done with you.
So, well, we have a website.
We do.
Where you can find any and all ONUC information you are looking for.
Yes.
I literally find any way that you want to follow us there.
Mm-hmm.
If you love our podcast as much as we do, please follow us, recommend us to friends, family, anyone.
Yep.
Anyone. And also go leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, please.
If you give us a 1-star, we will give you the cut direct. But other than that, we will not.
And I will read your review on air. But that is not for, but if you also leave us a good 5-star review, I will also read that on air.
And you'll get a prize.
Yes, you will.
Give us a way to give it to you.
You will. We do have a Patreon if you would like to help with the cost of hosting and making the show.
We're totally up into that.
Yes. We appreciate you guys for listening to this week's episode
very much
of One Nation Under Crime.
Oh, and also we're recording on Sunday. This is coming out on Monday. Today's
yes.
Kayla's birthday.
Yes,
happy birthday
it is.
To
thank you.
You.
I yes,
happy
it is
birthday
my birthday.
To you.
So we will see you here. Same time.
Different crime.
Maybe.
Oh, no.
Maybe it's not a crime.
Dun, dun, dun.
It reminds me of the dramatic squirrel. Like, dun, dun, dun. Turns his head to the side. Anyways.
Stay tuned.
And remember, there isn't always liberty and justice for all. We will see you guys on the 4th of July.
Oh, fireworks.
Yes.
Bow, 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 bow.
Goodbye.
Bye.